welcome back to the Land and Climate Podcast. This week I spoke to Faustine Badefosse about the possible rollback of European environmental protections now taking place in the European capital, Brussels. Faustine is Director of Nature, Health and Environment at the European Environmental Bureau, a Europe-wide citizen environmental organisation.
It is a symptom of a broken system. Farmers are the first victim of a food system that is unsustainable and healthy and completely broken.
I began by asking her if she could explain what had actually been happening to green agriculture and why it was so significant.
Back in December 2019, after the green wave in the parliament, which itself was triggered by the climate strikes from the youth in the streets, we saw the birth of the Green Deal, which ultimately is about reaching climate neutrality by 2050 to stay within the 1.5 degrees global warming. But it is quite interesting because it's a systemic project, which is not just looking at climate per se, but which is to tackle the triple crisis that we're faced with, which is pollution, nature, and climate. And of course, agriculture is playing a big role in this. Intensive agriculture is a driver of pollution. I mean, some practices are a driver of pollution, of nature loss, but also strengthening climate change or intensifying climate change. So this project was put on the table back in December 2019. And I must say that despite the COVID crisis, which was used by some as a justification to throw it in the bin already back then, it went through. And it was even strengthened through the COVID crisis. And Ursula von der Leyen at the time, saying that actually the Green Deal in itself was also a response to the pandemic and also helping to be resilient to potential future pandemic. So that's how we saw the birth of recovery national plans, which were strengthening the Green Deal in a way. But what we saw from 2022 onwards was a start of the dismantling of the Green Deal. This was triggered by the war in Ukraine, by the fact that some had been using it, has been instrumentalizing the war to push, you know, against key milestones of the project. One of them being the Nature Restoration Law. And why I'm speaking about the Nature Restoration Law, because it is quite essential and fundamental for farming as well. Because if farmers want to be able to be resilient to climate change, which we see is worsening and is the threat number one to food security today, they need to do it with nature and we need to restore nature. It is a matter of survival for all of us, but it is very important for farming and for food security. Yet what we've seen back in 2022 was, you know, like some, including politicians in the main party, in the EPP, the party of the president of the commission, basically surfing on disinformation and saying things like the Nature Restoration Law will lead to starvation in Europe, we won't be competitive anymore, our farm sector will suffer from lack of competitiveness, etc., etc., etc. And that was the beginning of race to the bottom. After the attack against the Nature Restoration Law, we saw that pesticides regulation, which was aiming at cutting by half the use of pesticides by 2030, which is extremely important because we see that pesticides are driving insects decline and therefore birds declines. And these are very essential also for pollinization, for farming, etc. There was a strong attack against that as well. And eventually it fell and we have no pesticides regulation under this mandate. But there were other pieces of the Green Deal that were under attack as well. And all of them touching upon, you know, farming from far or close. And even more recently, I mean, there was an acceleration. I mean, really, you could see as we were getting closer to the European elections scheduled for between the 6th and the 9th of June within the EU, we even started to go backwards on existing pieces of legislation. So this has happened with the Common Agricultural Policy, so the CAP, as we say, which basically is a sum of subsidies going to the farming sector. It's around a third of the EU budget, so it's not nothing. It's more than 55 billions of euros that we're spending annually from taxpayers' money on that policy. And it's a policy that until now has failed to help farmers to transit towards sustainable farming. It's a policy that until now has actually boosted intensification of farming, productivism, and against, you know, the resilience of our farming sector. And what we have seen recently is a reform of the Common Agricultural Policy in just a month and a half. So it had happened at the beginning of the Green Deal, actually, that the CAP was in the process of being reformed back then in 2019. Back then already, there was strong opposition to link the Common Agricultural Policy with the objective of the Green Deal. Actually, there was a political choice not to have a binding link between the objectives of the Common Agricultural Policy and the Green Deal. This was pushed by the agriculture ministers around Europe. But yet there was a reform. It took 3 years for that reform to go through. Thousands of amendments in the European Parliament, and also lots of changes from the Council, which is made of agriculture ministers. And what we've seen in the last couple of weeks was that there was a reform that went through in just a month and a half. No amendment, nothing. There was no public consultation. There was no searching. There was no impact assessment. This was just a response. This is how it was presented by the European Commission to the farmers' protests, saying, we hear you. And the response is just to target the last environmental safeguards of the Common Agricultural Policy. Because what was that reform was about? It was about removing the little conditions that you have in the Common Agricultural Policy, the so-called good agronomic practices, agro-environmental practices, that you have to fulfill in order to receive the subsidies. This reform, this express reform, this fastest reform ever, just scrapped them. Again, no public consultation, no impact assessment. To finish on that, which was even more shocking, because it was meant to be a response to the farmers' protest. But we know that the first threat, according to science, it's not us saying that, it's science, to farming and to food security is actually climate change and biodiversity loss. So targeting the environmental bits doesn't sound really quite right. It was presented as a simplification package, but there are many analysts that are actually questioning whether or not it will lead to any simplification. But the worst was that actually, while the Commission had consulted with four farm unions, so there was no public consultation of the wider public, but they had consulted in 1 week only with four farming unions, COPACOGECA, so the largest farm unions, IFOAM, the organic ones, Via Campesina, so that's more the peasant small farmers, and SEJA, the young farmers. Actually, they have only listened to one, to the demand of the largest farm unions, to COPACOGECA. And you even had a letter from IFOAM, so the organic and the small farmers, saying clearly to the head of the commission, to Ursula von der Leyen, that they had been consulted, but they have not been heard.
Does that mean that European agriculture could be even less climate and environmentally friendly than before?
Potentially, by scrapping the agri-environmental conditions, then, you know, you're removing the tiny link that you had between good practices, let's say, and the subsidies that are given to the sector. Beyond that, what that means is that there is no legitimacy for that policy anymore, because what the studies and the analysis of the Common Agricultural Policy have been pointing for the last couple of years is that this policy is failing in helping farmers to actually implement the transition that is urgent and necessary, and to adopt agroecological practices and more sustainable practices. For now, the CAP, as it is designed, and this area-based payment, so basically the bigger you are, the more payments you get, is driving intensification of the practices. And for now, this is also a figure that comes very often, but I think it's so shocking that it should be repeated, is that 80% of the subsidies under the CAP are going to 20% of the farmers. And today in Europe, more than half of the farmers are around 5 hectares or below 5 hectares, yet they have to share 6% of the direct payments, which is the most important pillar of the Common Agricultural Policy, so the biggest chunk of the cake. There is a need to completely rethink that policy, because now it is not helping. So this fastest ever reform is just going to make a situation that is already bad even worse. And the thing is that we have very little time. In March, you had this publication of the European Environmental Agency, this report on climate risk, this first ever climate risk assessment. And the conclusion is clear. Europe is the fastest warming continent in the world. And we are not ready. And one of the bigger threats is to food security. And what is very cynical is that the ones who have actually dismantled the Green Deal have done that under the name of food security, actually.
Maybe it would be time to go into some of who these figures are.
I mentioned the largest farm union that has been the only one being listened to, Copacogeca. They have been the ones actually opposing to the nature restoration law. That was quite clear, I mean, from their press releases. And you could see also the same messages from some of the politicians in the largest party, the EPP, and Copacogeca. It was literally the same wording and, you know, about, yes, the nature restoration law will lead to starvation, to drop in competitiveness, etc. I mean, this was scaremongering, basically. So you have these actors, you have these large farm unions and some actors within the agro-business who have a strong interest in maintaining the statu quo and whatever it costs, because the cost of inaction is huge and much, much, much bigger than the cost of action for society. But given that we're getting closer and closer to the elections, of course, there is also an interest in the parties which are not in favor of more Europe and who really see the Green Deal as, you know, like these European projects, and which is also, you know, I mean, let's face it, climate neutrality is also moving away from fossil fuels, etc. And these players have an interest in keeping, you know, this fossil fuels-based economy, etc., who are actually, you know, targeting it in order to destabilize the EU and also ahead of the elections. And the message that they are spreading around is that the Green Deal is a beast that we need to target and which represents, you know, this technocrat, this ecolo, and these green extremists, and etc. They're even saying that decision makers and the EU is planning to exterminate farmers. I mean, that's the words that they are using. Extermination of farmers by restoring nature, which is essential for the survival of farmers, by the way. I mean, this is disinformation, but we know on social media that it works very well.
We did a previous podcast actually on pesticides, and I remember one of the points made was about there are also maybe some structural interests, at least that was suggested, within DG Agriculture, or the agricultural DG, which might play against other interests in other commission directorates, against the health directorate for impacts on health, or the climate directorate. I mean, do you agree with that? Are there tensions within the European Commission where it seems that the agricultural lobby within that is winning out?
Well, from what we have seen with the Sustainable Food Systems Law, which was aborted before seeing the light of the day, it seems to be the case, yes, because this law, which was actually most likely the best response to the farmers' protest, tackling finally, you know, the issue of prices, but also helping with income in order, you know, by targeting the middle chain, you know, actors, the retailers, the distributors, the processors, etc., who are the ones setting the price, and farmers are suffering from that. But also, of course, marketing and consumers, etc. I mean, it was really a systemic and coherent approach. It was led by DG Santé. DG Agri was not chef de file. From what we have understood, this was one of the reasons why also this has not gone through. DG Agri wanted to be in charge, even though, again, it was going much beyond production, because it was like looking at the whole chain, but they felt like, you know, they were losing power. And you just have to look at the numbers as well. I mean, historically, I mean, this DG has been extremely powerful. I mean, it's where you have the highest number of civil servants as well. So, of course, they have much more means than DG Environment, for instance, which is very little. That picture is also true at national level. I mean, you know, my organization is working with national organizations. I mean, we are a federation of national NGOs, and we see exactly the same at national level, where the environment ministry, you know, has no say or even little, and everything which is linked from far or close to agriculture is led by the Ministry for Agriculture. And because you said the lobby in these institutions, just to give you an example, in the council, so where you have the agriculture ministers who are sitting, every time they have a meeting, before that meeting, they have a dinner with COPACOGECA. It's as if COPACOGECA were holding their hands, you know, but nobody says anything. And the same in the European Parliament, in the Committee for Agriculture, actually, a lot of the members, even themselves, their partners are farmers, or they have like some links from far or close to the agribusiness, and it doesn't seem to bother anyone. So yes, you know, the agribusiness lobby is everywhere in these institutions. It is true for the Commission, but it is even more so true for the Council and for the Parliament, which is where decisions are taken, because the Commission is proposing, but it's eventually the Parliament and the Council, actually even more so the Council, the ministers, who are deciding.
Can we talk a little bit more about the farmer protests within all this and what part they have played?
Yeah, it's very interesting, this protest, because there was a little bit of cacophony in a way. Because what was quite special with this protest, at least when they started, it was not initiated by the large farm unions initially. It is a symptom of a broken system. Farmers are the first victim of a food system that is unsustainable and healthy and completely broken. They went in the street to actually ask for a decent income, because for now they struggle to live from their activities, and also to have better prices, because many farmers are struggling to actually cover the cost of that they have for their production with the price. They are price taker. They are not setting the price. They are dictated the price by the other actors in the chain. But very quickly, you saw like a flip, you know, where the large farms unions, actually they saw that bridge and they just jumped in there, and they used that anger, which can be understood from the farmers. And let's say also that, of course, this issue of price and income is worsened by the fact that they are faced with climate change and floods and droughts, and it's more and more difficult. We see yields dropping. I mean, in the context of, I think it was Greece, in the report from the European Environmental Agency, it says that back in autumn 2023, in the Daniel, with the storm Daniel, just because of the floods from that storm, Greece has lost 15% of its annual yield. The prices, the income, and the climate change, the biodiversity loss, soil depletion, etc. The large farm unions, you know, like jumped in it, and they basically said that farmers' anger was driven by the bureaucracy coming from Brussels and by all the different legislations, etc., the Green Deal, and the Green Deal became the beast to target. Actually, the Green Deal has nothing to do with agriculture, because all the bits that relate from far or close to farming in the Green Deal had not grown through. So there is nothing in the Green Deal that matters and is, you know, for farmers so far, even though we need it. But so these claims were completely false and wrong. But yet, you know, they went through, they became the dominant narrative. I mean, we saw countries, and I'm very ashamed of them, like mine, like France, you know, like being very strong and clear. And, you know, yes, we have heard farmers, we need to remove all the administrative burdens. And what are administrative burdens, according to my French agri-ministers? Environmental legislation. And then that became really the dominant narrative. And then, of course, you had far right, you know, which, again, that was an opportunity to hit very hard the Green Deal and therefore Europe, the European projects, etc., you name it. And this is how it ended. And I must say they were very successful, because eventually we saw that express reform of the Common Agricultural Policy. And now another proposal that came completely out of the blue, which is to revise the Nitrates Directive, which is a fundamental, I mean, such an important milestone in the environmental acquis of the EU, which is there to protect us from polluted water, from an overuse of fertilizers and manure. And they are scrapping, you know, like the pollution limits, etc. I mean, this is what they are proposing. We've seen, you know, in that big mess, like some farmers, you know, who are still there asking for a better income, you know, and prices, and also saying we need better support for the transition. We know that the big threat is actually climate change, and who are already doing a lot and who are not supported enough for what they are doing vis-a-vis the others who are not doing enough and who get the bulk of the subsidies. and they were not heard. But there is also responsibility from the media there, because they would always talk to the largest one, to the ones who were screaming the loudest, and not to the other ones. And then eventually the bad thing was that we put everyone in the same basket. And we also saw that there were lots of even unlawful behavior. The images were striking, where you saw some farmers destroying even like public monuments in Brussels, etc. Then there was a polarization. Fair enough, and I would understand why, because, you know, you would see a treatment, a special treatment for farmers, you know, where nobody would say anything. The police was just watching. Well, actually, when you had peaceful protests from environmentalists, you know, like screaming for more environmental regulation, etc., to protect us and our children, you know, they would get beaten and sent to jail.
Now, of course, we've got a European Parliament election coming. Have the farmer protests actually reinforced the anti-environmental views which exist as well? And do you see that manifesting itself with more anti-environmental MEPs?
It seems like it, yes. I mean, not only we've seen this impact on the legislation per se and this rollback, but we've also seen that the farmers' protests have somehow had an impact also on what the parties were proposing, because it was at the same time happening at the same time as the parties were finalizing their projects, let's say their manifesto for the post elections. And you could see that all of them had like, oh, we are the farmers' party. We want to defend farmers and deregulation, etc. I mean, the EPP first, like clearly saying in its party manifesto that they actually want to scrap not only the nature restoration law, which anyway is not there yet, but existing biodiversity law, like the Natura 2000 and the Nature's Directive, which are such an important milestone and so important, I mean, like part of the environmental acquis, like the Nature's Directive. So it had huge impact, yes, clearly already. And now if we look at the projections, unfortunately, it seems that they are also having an impact, because we see that the far right's groups are gaining seats in the projections. I mean, the most recent one show that it is increasing. I mean, according to the projections, the far right, so Identité and Democracy, might be the third group. I mean, you know, now it's Renew, but, you know, they might win over Renew, which of course would be very dangerous for the future of Europe. But for me, it's more like the instrumentalization of the farmers' protests, because I think it's very important to bear in mind again that at the beginning, there were legitimate demands coming from farmers and, you know, about income, about prices, and also in the context of climate change or biodiversity loss, etc., which have been instrumentalized by the large one against environmental law for maintaining the statu quo and not having to bother with anything, and from the far right, so a way to even increase further their popularity and their potential, you know, win for these elections. And I've been talking to farmers also individually, and I really try to remind them that it's not the case of all farmers in Europe. Not all farmers are in favor of far right, etc. I mean, not at all. I mean, I think it's important to say as well. But we've seen in the Salon de l'Agriculture in France, for instance, that when the head of the far-right party entered the room, he got like big round of applause, you know, that was extremely disturbing. And I think they need to be reminded that these parties are fighting for less Europe, and less Europe in the case of farming would be extremely, extremely, extremely detrimental. Not just talking about the environment and climate, which again are the main threats to farming, but simply the common agricultural policy. I mean, they're screaming for simplification. Do we really think that having 27 national agri-policy will help in any way? I mean, and the end of the common market, I don't think that they are in favor of that. And actually, when you talk to them individually, they have not necessarily thought about that, because behind these parties, this is what you have, you know, is this, they are against the European project, not in favor of that. And I think that people tend to forget about that. And last but not least, they should also look at how they've been voting under this mandate, and what interest they are actually representing, all these different parties. And we've actually done that work in my organization. You know, we've done a scoreboard analyzing the votes of the different parties in all the countries on climate, nature, and pollution, including many files like the Common Agricultural Policy, but also the pesticide regulation, which was killed, but we have analyzed it, etc.
What solutions do you see? What could be happening with the Common Agricultural Policy, for example? I mean, it's the reforms of the Common Agricultural Policy have been talked about for years. Where should we be going?
It's quite depressing. It's quite worrying, yes, but we are in the eve of a major turning point, let's say, and the elections can be a game changer. Let's remember that back in 2019, the projections were wrong and we had that green wave. So we can have another case where the projections will be eventually wrong. And what we now see is that the ones that we hear are the ones that scream the loudest, right? And that's true for social media and everything. But I do believe that there is space for hope. We do believe that also in the organization. And that's actually why we have, actually on Monday, in the occasion of our 50th anniversary, published the Pact for the Future, which is our vision from fear to hope, which is building on the Green Deal and also filling the gaps, etc., and also really emphasizing on the just transition and a socially fair transition, because this is maybe what was also missing from that Green Deal and which is partially responsible also about the anger of some. And this is something that is very important in our project. And we're really calling people to think in terms of hope, and that hope can materialize only if people go and vote. And there are a lot of what we call the stay-at-home progressive, the ones who care, really, who understand that climate change is an existential threat, the ones who understand that biodiversity decline is a threat to humanity, the ones who care about their children's future, they need to understand that by voting, actually, they can change the rule of the game, really. And that would also be a strong message. And yes, we would have lost several years, because these last 2 years means that we have lost 2 years, and 2 years when you are in such a hurry in order not to miss your target is bad, but there is still a little bit of time and we should really not miss that opportunity. Because indeed, then after the elections, if projections are wrong, then there will be strong reasons to be extremely depressed. But for now, I don't want to be depressed.
Thanks very much to Faustine for her time. As usual, if you're interested, you can find a list of suggested further reading on this subject on our podcast blurb. We also have new interesting pieces and investigations, which you can read on our Land and Climate Review website. Thanks to Vasco Kostovsky for producing the show, and we'll be back again in 2 weeks' time. Thanks for listening.